Welcome to Terror at Collinwood. 'Tis I, Penny Dreadful. And now I'm being forced to drink this noxious potion provided to me by Dr. Cyrus Longworth in order to transform into... I don't feel anything. Danielle, and welcome to the show. Big congratulations to Grim Life Collective, who won Best Podcast in the Rondo Awards. No surprise, but certainly deserved. They're a great YouTube travel series. They go to different horror-themed locations. I knew they were going to win because they have over 500,000 subscribers on YouTube, which is well-deserved. But Terror at Collinwood came in second again, 3 years in a row. Terror at Collinwood came in second, which in and of itself is an honor. So thank you very much to those who voted in the Rondo Awards. And certainly thank you to those who took the time to vote for Terror at Collinwood in the Rondo Awards. I sincerely appreciate it. And hey, maybe next year we'll do it. I have some quick news before we get started. There's a great new weekly Dark Shadows live streamed talk show, Dark Shad Bros, hosted by three delightful gentlemen, Peter Mack, who Terror at Collinwood listeners heard back in episode 6, DJ Schaefer, and Michael Panzerotto. The show is streamed on both Facebook and YouTube every Friday night at 8 p.m. Eastern Time. I'll put links in the show notes. I watched the first episode and it was most enjoyable, and I think you'll really like it, so I encourage you to check it out. Again, it's called Dark Shad Bros. I'm really happy to see new Dark Shadows programs coming into existence. These guys are longtime Dark Shadows fans, friends with some of the actors too, so they have some great stories to share, and definitely check it out. And also, just a quick reminder that the Dark Shadows Remembrance Weekend is coming up on July 5th and 6th in Burbank, California. I'll put a link to all the information in the show notes. Friday night's a celebration of life for Lara Parker, and Saturday is the Jonathan Frid Centenary. It'll also be a day trip to Greystone, the mansion used as Collinwood, and the old house too, in the 1991 Dark Shadows Revival series. There's going to be a garden tour on the afternoon of the 5th. That will cost $25. A link to the event page is in the show notes. And just a reminder, the Friday night celebration for Lara is not a convention. It is a memorial event, the Jonathan Frid event. The next day is a little bit more convention-like. I think there are going to be some vendors there and on the Saturday and Q&A panels. Several of the actors will be in attendance. And I will be there. I'm very excited. I'm looking forward to meeting you. Please do come over and say hello. I would love to chat with you. And speaking of chatting, I'm going to yak your ear off in this episode. Let's get to the show. So a few months ago, I released the first installment of the Dark Shadows podcast of questions and answers, which was an idea inspired by Dale Clark's Dark Shadows books of questions and answers. I'm a big fan of what's called a spackling, which is coming up with in-show explanations for inconsistencies, continuity errors, and just speculating about the plots and characters in the show. I do a lot of interviews on this podcast, but one thing I really like to talk about, I mentioned it even way back in episode 1, In fact, one of the questions I'm going to address today is something I brought up in episode one of the podcast. But I like speculating about this stuff and discussing it. I'm fully aware that the real world answers to these things are because the writers may have forgotten or they just decided to retcon things. I understand that, as I am not delusional, at least not completely. But I like to look at things through a more formalist lens, using the text itself and not worrying about what Gordon Russell had for breakfast that day. That might have made him forget that 1797 was actually supposed to be 1795 and or 1796. A lot of fans of speculative fiction like doing this sort of thing, no matter what it is, whether it's TV shows or book series or comic books, especially with the continuity of serialized comics that have been going on for decades. Comic book fans definitely do this kind of stuff. But let's just jump into this and not dilly-dally any longer. So question number one, where was the family secret in 1840? This is the question I asked way back in episode one of the podcast 3 years ago. And I'm gonna try and tackle this one because this is a head scratcher. A major plot point in the early part of the 1897 storyline, as we know, was the family secret, which was passed down presumably from Joshua to Daniel, to Gabriel, to Edith, and then she was going to pass it on to Edward. Now, of course, we know the family secret was the vampire Barnabas Collins, who was chained in his coffin in the secret room of the mausoleum. However, when we get to 1840, Daniel Collins seems completely unaware of the family secret. He should have known it at this point. Presumably it was Joshua who told him. Maybe it was Ben. It's possible that it was Ben, because I don't know if in 1897, I don't think Edith flat out said that Joshua told Daniel. She just said it was passed down from generation to generation, which implies that it was Joshua who told Daniel. For the purposes of this, let's just assume going in that it was Joshua told Daniel, Daniel told Gabriel, Gabriel told Edith. Okay, so initially, Daniel thinks that Barnabas is the original one from his childhood, but seems totally unaware of the secret. So how is this possible? I have two possible explanations. The kind of the easy one is that Daniel was suffering from some kind of early onset dementia. He seemed unwell, although later, after Quentin returns, he definitely seems to return to his senses quite a bit more. Maybe it's the way that he was being treated in 1840 that kind of was making him behave that way, and also that he murdered his wife. You know, that might have also played into his mental state. But it's possible that Daniel simply forgot due to his state of mind, and that this memory was suppressed somehow, or that his memory was tampered with by some supernatural force. Maybe in the original run of events, the memory resurfaced in time for him to tell Gabriel. However, in the altered run of events, this never happened. Barnabas's and Julia's presence in 1840 prevented this trajectory from taking place. We did see that Barnabas directly interfered with things in 1840. For example, in episode 1159, Gabriel intercepts a letter from Quentin I to Daniel. In the original run of events, Gabriel was presumably going to destroy or more likely totally rewrite the letter. Barnabas wasn't there to interfere. So instead, in this version, in the altered version, Barnabas does interfere and make sure that the letter is delivered to Daniel. So it's possible that the memory came back to Daniel later on when in the original run of events. However, that is one scenario. I used to adhere more to that scenario when I was younger. When I was a teenager, that was my go-to answer for this. Now I have a different theory. Okay, I'm leaning into this one, and you tell me what you think. History was changed between what we saw in 1897 and what we saw in 1840 due to one brief jaunt to the past. There's only one time in between 1897 and 1840 that we go to the past pre-1840. In episode 885, Barnabas returns to 1795/1797, and I addressed this in the last questions and answers episode in terms of all the time travel and weakening of barriers to multiple universes, causing timelines to become hazy and bleed into each other, causing the different dates, the fluctuation in dates in Dark Shadows. That's how I explain the changing dates on the tombstones and grave markers as well, and that applies to the 1795/1796/1797 conundrum. But that's a separate topic, and I did address that a bit in the last questions and answers episode I did. Anyway, there was this one single jaunt to the 18th century between the 1897 storyline and the 1840 storyline. And who did we meet but the Leviathans, Oberon and Hazza? For the first time, we met the Leviathans, who wanted, at all costs, to make sure Barnabas made it back to the present day as their agent. The Leviathans, who we ultimately learn are in league with Diabolos, interfered with history in the 18th century to make sure their goals were met. My feeling is that they did more tinkering during this time and made sure that the passing down of the family secret did not happen. They wanted to ensure that Barnabas would remain as safe as possible in order to further their agenda. Thus, it was the Leviathans who altered the original run of events upon their arrival on the scene, as of episode 886, and made sure the family secret was not passed down from Joshua to Daniel. How they did that, that's conjecture. We could have come up with a number of scenarios to explain how they interfered and prevented that secret from being passed down, but I think it was the Leviathans, because they were there in the 18th century interfering, wanting Barnabas specifically, because he's been traveling through time. They liked that he could bring the Leviathan Messiah into the presence, the essence of the Leviathan creature who would become Jeb Hawks into the present. They wanted to make sure that happened, so I think they did more tinkering than what we saw. So that's my current theory on why the family secret didn't see it in 1840, because by then the Leviathans had interfered in the chain of events. There's also a third possibility, and I think this is the one Dale Clark mentioned in the Dark Shadows books of Questions and Answers. His thought was that when Barnabas did go into the past in that one episode at the end of 1897, that his actions changed history to such a degree that it inadvertently caused the family secret to not be passed down. So that was another possibility as well. And I can see that as well, because clearly Barnabas's presence, his choices that he made, changed history big time. And I want to address that in a later episode, because the whole Josette drinking poison instead of jumping off Widow's Hill is a huge change to the fabric of Dark Shadows. That is a major ongoing thing in the series, to the point where changing that, I am shocked that the writers would dare to do that. I mean, she still commits suicide, but no Widow's Hill? Unacceptable. Unacceptable. History must reassert itself. Somehow things must revert back to Josette jumping off Widow's Hill. I don't know how it happens, but that's like one of those fixed points in history. And speaking of, that leads me to the next question. So since Edith Collins died in the altered version of 1840, wouldn't this severely alter the 1897 we saw? Sadly, yes, it would. Absolutely. Major change there, and I'm not a fan of that happening. We know that Quentin is still around in 1971. We find that out, but we never get to see him after Barnabas, Julia, and Professor Stokes return to the present day. He's at the Historical Society to see Roger's speech, right? So who knows exactly what the altered 1897 was like? Quentin would be the one to ask. You know, he may start referencing things that were totally different from what we saw, but my feeling is that it didn't change all that much. I think time righted itself. There are some things that I think are required to happen timeline-wise, and maybe it's just because I love 1897 so much, I hate the idea of it changing so drastically. So I think Edith may not have died after Gabriel strangled her. And I'm going to read you a quote here from an article by Craig Clipper from Inside the Old House, number 38, another Dale Clark publication. And it's a really nice kind of way to sum up what may have happened, in my opinion, to kind of restore things to close to what they were. Not exactly what we saw in 1897, but close. So Mr. Clipper's theory here, he says, for anyone who wants to argue that Edith must have survived 1840, here's an interesting bit of information. Less than 2 days pass between Edith's death and our departure from 1840. Only two people actually see her body, Gabriel, her murderer and a madman, and Daphne, who may have been hysterical at the time. Could Gabriel have botched the job? He may have only stunned Edith, and she could have been recovering even as Daphne found her in the closed wing. Reviving, she could have fled the house as quietly as possible and hid in town until she heard Gabriel was dead a day later. Imagine the reaction when she walks back into Collinwood moments after Desmond has destroyed the staircase through time. Also, imagine her fight to gain control of the family fortune over the next few years. I really like that idea. This idea that she somehow survived and came back, and they let her stay at the house, and she gradually kind of manipulated things so that she would take control of Collinwood, as we saw. Now, she may have discovered the secret of Barnabas on her own. She may have learned the secret of the mausoleum. You know, we can speculate about different ways that may have happened, but she may have uncovered that and thus restoring the idea that she's going to pass the family secret on to Edward in 1897. So the time kind of writes itself there. It's a little different, but she still has that information and she's still alive. Another theory that I read many years ago that I thought was kind of interesting too was by the late great Warren Otson in the Dark Shadows 1840 Concordance in his wonderful essay, Causality at Collinwood, which I've referenced a few times. And Warren's thought is that due to her joining Judah/Gerard's coven, she was perhaps given a chance to return to Earth by Diabolos. She was resurrected by him as an agent of Diabolos, as a witch, potentially, but then maybe later repented of her wicked ways, you know, and was thus the more jovial Edith who we saw later on. That's also a possibility that she kind of came back from death due to her pact that she made with Judah/Gerard. And that one also works for me because there's a supernatural component there. It would explain how she was dead and then comes back again. And she could say that she wasn't dead. She was just seriously injured or stunned or unconscious or whatever. So you could play with that. I think it's fairly easy to bring Edith back. It's Dark Shadows, of course it is. If you die on Dark Shadows, flip the coin as to whether you're going to come back or not. There's so much to unpack in 1840. It's really a lot. And a whole questions and answers episode of the podcast could be devoted to the original and very different run of events in 1840, given what we learned in the summer of 1970. It's the most mind-bendingly frustrating part of the show in terms of continuity, but it can work if you put the pieces together the right way. I've done it before. I think when I was a teenager, I tried to work it out, how what happened originally in 1840 from piecing it together from what we learned in summer of 1970 and how it changed once Julia and then Barnabas and then Professor Stokes showed up in 1840 and interfered in events, and how Angelique also worked into that because, you know, she was visiting the mausoleum every year, but she wasn't interacting with the people at Collinwood. So there was a whole lot happening here that didn't happen in the original run of events that totally changed it, drastically changed it from what we saw when we got there. That could take an entire episode for sure to talk about that, and I hope to do that at some point. But that's gonna take some time to put something like that together. And I don't even know if anybody really besides me really wants to hear something like that. I don't even know if anybody wants to hear this, what I'm doing right now. But I like doing these speculation episodes. All right, so let's move on. Keep things moving here. What happened to the link between Barnabas and Adam? Okay, so as we know, Barnabas provided the life force for Adam, and they shared a link. They shared a bond. Whatever Adam felt, Barnabas felt. Whatever Barnabas felt, Adam felt. It was like the Corsican brothers of Dark Shadows here. So one felt what was going on with the other. If Adam died, the curse would return to Barnabas. So there was this whole link between them. But in episode 661, Barnabas calls upon the spirit of Peter Bradford in an incantation where he beseeches Peter Bradford to open the way for him into the past, and he is physically willed, he's transported back to 1796, Barnabas. Now, when this happens, I believe that the connection between Barnabas and Adam was effectively and immediately severed, because it's never mentioned again. Now, an interesting possibility is that Adam himself was also whisked back in time and forced to live out the centuries as an immortal man-made creature. But my gut tells me that it was simply that the connection was severed in episode 661. The last time we saw Adam was in episode 636, which was only a little over a month earlier. So this nicely explains why the connection between the two was never addressed or mentioned again. It was never affected Barnabas again in any way that we saw. And I think just a little over a month after we last saw Adam, that connection was severed in 661. And the Sam Hall TV Guide article isn't canon, so let's not go there. Because Sam Hall in that article brings back the connection between Barnabas and Adam, which was not mentioned for like 2.5 years, and all of a sudden it's back again. No. Sorry, Sam Hall. I revere the work you did in Dark Shadows, but you did not plot the entire show by yourself. Dan Curtis was, let's face it, Dan Curtis was the de facto head writer on the show. If Dan Curtis said, we're going to do killer chickens today, they'd have to come up with a script for that. So sorry, if that article had been written with Sam Hall, Dan Curtis, Gordon Russell, and Violet Wells, then I would be all in. And especially Dan Curtis. So you'd have to have Sam Hall and Gordon Russell for sure. Violet Wells, ideally, and maybe Joel Caldwell too, although he was already had been gone for quite a bit. Violet was still ghostwriting up until the end. So I'm going to say Sam Hall, Gordon Russell, Violet Wells, plus especially Dan Curtis. Okay, let's move on. Next question. What was the job Barnabas commanded Willie to do? Now, I actually answered this in response to a listener question back in episode 21 of the podcast, but I'll touch on it here. If you look at Willie's reaction to the job Barnabas is telling him to do, Willie is absolutely terrified and repulsed by what he has to do. I mean, he's practically trembling. It must be something awful. He's bringing victims to Barnabas. And he's burying some of them too, the ones who die. He's picking up ladies of the night in nearby towns and bringing them to some predetermined location Barnabas told him about so that he can feed on them. And he probably ends up killing some of them through strangulation so that they don't rise as vampires. And Willie is then tasked with disposing of the corpses in the instances where these victims die. And of course, he's doing all of this against his will because he's the vampire's thrall. He has no choice in the matter. He's picking up probably prostitutes, you know, and he's bringing them to Barnabas. He's leading them to the slaughter, or at least to be fed on by Barnabas. Maybe they don't all die. You know, he's probably careful to some degree, but sometimes he can't control them. Himself. He's overcome by the bloodlust, and sometimes he goes too far. But either way, this is a horrific thing that Willie has to do. And John Carlin actually corroborated this part, at least part of this, in an interview during an early convention. I think it was back in the late 70s. It was probably one of the Shadow Cons. There was a transcript of a Q&A panel with him in one of the fanzines. Might have been the World of Dark Shadows. And when he was asked, he said he was bringing young women to Barnabas for him to feed on. I think he said he started by bringing him animals to feed on, and then it just graduated to people, like initially. And we saw it in the show, you know, the calves drained of blood in these farms, but Willie was probably, I mean, it's kind of ridiculous to imagine Willie bringing a calf to the old house. So maybe Carlin was kind of being cheeky about that, but then he said that he started bringing young ladies to Barnabas. It's really nasty, and it basically corroborates what I figured was going on when I watched this when I was a kid. I mean, I don't think I was thinking in terms of prostitutes, but I was thinking in terms of, like, he was bringing people to Barnabas for him to drink their blood and probably burying the bodies too. And as for the burying the bodies, this is actually something Willie says in the Big Finish, Kingdom of the Dead. I think it was Kingdom of the Dead, audio drama. I mean, again, audio drama is not canon, but it certainly makes sense and falls in line with what I'm thinking here. Barnabas refers to him as a friend, and Willie replies, "Friend, I was your slave. I buried bodies for you." It was something to that effect. So, I mean, it all kind of fits into place pretty well, especially if you look at Willie's horror-stricken reaction when Barnabas tells him he has a job to do and says, "Go now." You can tell Willie's repulsed and horrified by this. Next question. Why is David no longer afraid of Barnabas after 1795? Okay, I've heard this question brought up so many times over the years. It is a big one. This one drives a lot of people crazy, but I think it's a pretty easy one to answer. And I've mentioned it actually a couple of times on the podcast before, just during discussions with guests. Right after 1795 and before the Dr. Lang cure, Barnabas finds David. I think David was in Boston. So let's say Barnabas takes a trip down to Boston. He's determined to nip this in the bud. He finds David, gets him alone, makes him stare into his eyes, and uses his vampiric hypnotic powers to erase David's memory or suppress David's memory of him being undead. It's possible that he also did this after David got back to Collinwood right before. I mean, the experiment, I think, happens the next day after David gets back. But right before that, Barnabas is definitely reverting back to his vampire state. The dogs are howling and everything. So his powers were probably still intact to some degree, so he may have even used his powers at that point. He might have waited for David to come back and still been able to do that. So either way, I think it comes down to Barnabas using his hypnotic abilities to erase or suppress David's memory. We literally saw Barnabas do this on screen twice with children who discovered his secret. One was Nora Collins in 1897, episode 783, when she saw him biting Charity. And again with Daniel Collins in 1970 Parallel Time, episode 1013, when Daniel discovers him in Angelique's room. Of course, unlike the other two, David was terrorized by Barnabas for a substantial period of time. That's not something that's easy to forget, but nevertheless, I maintain that Barnabas used his power powers as a vampire to suppress David's memories. And I don't think that he completely wiped David's memory. I think there was too much that happened, that things kind of keep bubbling to the surface there. I think David maintained some awareness that Barnabas was preternatural in some way, because during that, I love that line in Summer of 1970 where David says, Barnabas is different. Like, he just knows there's something different about Barnabas, even though those memories have been suppressed, there's still some inkling of that. And that's what I think happened. It just makes the most sense. You know, he finally was like, oh, I can just do this instead of killing the kid, which thankfully he did not do that. We may also consider the Cassandra factor. Cassandra Collins, aka Angelique, was present at the time and used her powers immediately on David when he caught her making out with Tony Peterson. So she may have learned that he learned about Barnabas and wiped his memory too. So that's another option as well. Okay, moving on to the next question. This is a weird one. You must intercede with Oscar. What does it mean? Okay, so in episode 683, Roger Collins finds an old letter addressed to Jameson from Quentin mentioning Oscar, and it's dated 1887. Jameson Collins in 1887, he would be really young. He'd be like 2 or 3 years old. So how could he read a letter sent to him by Quentin? And in the letter, Quentin mentions that only Jameson can save him and that he should intercede with Oscar on his behalf. And I can read the letter here. It says, "Dear Jameson, you must return to Collinwood. I need your help. You must intercede with Oscar. Only you can save me." And it's signed Quentin. So the real life answer to this, the real world answer to this, one part of this anyway, is that Edward Collins was originally meant to be named Oscar. That was the original name for the character, and they changed it to Edward before we got to 1897. By the time we got to 1897, his name had been changed to Edward. The other thing is that maybe they had not settled on the idea of that the date that they were going to time travel to was, if they even knew they were going to time travel at that point, was going to be 1897. Maybe at that time they were considering going to 1887 instead, and then they just retconned it to 1897. But we're not dealing with outside the show stuff here, right? We're trying to find in-show reasons for things. And if you have theories on this, please do not hesitate to share them, because this one is kind of a mind bender for me. But I have some thoughts about it. So this does fall in line with the sort of the relationship between Quentin and Jameson. They're close, but Quentin uses him to accomplish certain things, much as he did with David as a ghost. I mean, he's manipulates and uses Jameson to help him in his schemes, in his occult dabbling, all kinds of things that he does. Jameson helps him out. He's his little buddy, his accomplice, but, you know, he's a kid. But here, it's like 1887 and Oscar. So there are ways we can explain this. I think it's one of the games that Quentin played with Jameson when he was a child. Quentin and Jameson were close. They probably played games like weird occult and adventure games, weird time travel game, and a make-believe character that they created named Oscar in their game. And maybe it was Edward's middle name was Oscar and he hated it. They used it because they thought it was funny and it would tick him off. Quentin would encourage Jameson to use the name Oscar to irritate his father. I mean, I could totally see that happening. And as we saw with the ghost of Quentin and David and Amy, Quentin wants us to play the game. It was always games, but of course there were always ulterior motives, bad things that Quentin wanted to do. But I think that's part of it. These games that he would play with Jameson probably involved his dabbling in the occult as well, and using Jameson, as we saw him do in the show, to make things happen. So this might have tied in with that, but I don't know specifically why the 1887, there might be some reason for it, or it just might have just been some fantastical thing that they came up with as part of their fun game that they were playing. It doesn't explain why the letter just fell out of the book like that. I don't know, maybe it was Jameson's ghost. Somebody was trying to warn the Collins family. I think it was meant to be Magda's ghost who was trying to warn them about Quentin. So that might have been, again, a letter, part of Jameson and Quentin's occult game or whatever that they were playing. And Magda is warning them like, hey, he's back, you know, so watch out. Or it could have just been, I mean, this is Quentin as he's starting to manifest. He's not reached full power yet as a ghost. This is the beginnings of Quentin here, but it might have been something he planted there to mess with the family. You know, he wants to throw them off his trail. He knows the kids are going to release him. and he's going to gain in power. So he's trying to throw them off his scent with some bogus letter with a random date that makes no sense and a name of a person that never existed. Although I don't think Quentin was powerful enough yet to do that. He becomes extremely powerful later, but he's not there yet. So I don't know if he would have been able to do something like that to that degree, because he's still in the room at this point. He has not been released yet. He has yet to gain in power. My feeling is that this was some kind of game that Jameson and Quentin were playing, this note was just a complete fabrication as part of their whatever thing that they were doing. I don't know who knocked that book off the shelf, what spirit knocked that book off the shelf so they could find that. Magda, I guess, was trying to warn them about Quentin in some way. Maybe it was one of the few references to Quentin that was left in Collinwood. We did see his picture later, but there wasn't a whole lot of information about Quentin, and that was one of the few things. So maybe Magda was trying to tip them off, like, hey, this guy's coming back. He's trying to manifest and do some terrible things. So I think that's probably what it was. Okay, last question. When I do these in the future, I'll try to pull one or two questions from listener questions. This one comes from Serpenthrope on YouTube. It says, I just finished the Atom Arc. Was any explanation ever given for how Peter recognized Eve in the past when she was played by a different actress than the one who played Danielle Roget? Or Leona Eldridge. So in episode 622, Eve goes back in time to 1795/1796. And in 623, she has returned to being Danielle Roget, and Peter does indeed recognize her as such. And so does Ben, actually. So the role is played by Marie Wallace in this episode, not Erica Fitz, who played Leona Eldridge, aka Danielle Roget, earlier. And yet, Peter doesn't seem to notice that this is Eve now. And my feeling is that the magic that transported Eve to the past also made her appear as Danielle Roget to the eyes of others. So when Peter sees her, when Ben sees her, they're seeing Danielle Roget, even though we, the audience, are seeing Eve. Okay, Angelique was using magic. This is the supernatural, right? So I think obfuscating her appearance. And the others are seeing her as Danielle Roget while we, the audience, are seeing Eve. I think that's what we're meant to understand it as. Another option is that Eve merged with Danielle Roget in the past, and that while we, the audience, are seeing Eve, the characters are seeing someone who looks like Erica Fitz. Peter Bradford and Ben, the characters, are seeing Erica Fitz, but we are seeing Marie Wallace, the audience. I mean, it's a different scenario, but it's like the time Diana Walker played Carolyn. I mean, we see Diana Walker playing Carolyn, but the characters are simply seeing Carolyn. So, you know, they're not seeing the difference between Nancy Barrett and Diana Walker. So, I mean, it's a different situation, but I know Eve physically was transported back in time, but I think she kind of merged with Danielle Roget in some way, like in some weird metaphysical way. She merged with Danielle Roget, and those people in that time are seeing Danielle Roget versus, or at least the people who knew Danielle Roget are seeing her. And I'm also going to read a comment from Gothic 49, our dear Steve Schutt, who has been on the podcast a few times here. He commented, interesting comments about Quentin's original death scenario. I wonder if it was actually Amy's arrival that reawakened the troubled spirit of Quentin Collins. Isn't she the first one to speak to him on the old telephone? And if Quentin, in his wolf form, killed Nora, which was a theory I put forward in that episode, I wonder if the link was there because Amy was the reincarnation of Nora Collins. Interesting to speculate. We know because of what was revealed in 1897 that Chris and Amy were descendants of Quentin Collins through his daughter. Just interesting to muse about all of this. And my reply is, I think that's an excellent point regarding Amy's arrival triggering the troubled spirit of Quentin. And it especially makes sense if he did kill Nora when he was in werewolf form. I think he killed Nora and Carl too in 1897. If you listen to that original questions and answers episode, which I did back in episode 71, I talked a little bit about what I thought the original run of 1897 was like, and it was a much darker period of time than what we saw. I think things went down in a really bad way in 1897. And yeah, she is the first one to speak with him. And I think the combination of Amy and David being at Collinwood together as these sort of doppelgangers for Jameson and Nora, it was the equation that was needed to energize Quentin and Beth's activities. So I totally agree. It just makes sense to me anyway. I've rambled on quite a bit here. If you're still with me, you're a champ. Thanks for listening to Terror at Collinwood. And hey, I want to ask you to do me a favor, if you would. If you listen on Apple Podcasts, please rate and review the podcast. The reviews have been very sparse lately, and it's really important because if you review the podcast, if you rate the podcast, it does help the podcast to reach more eyes in terms of Dark Shadows fans. This is not a financial thing. I make no money on this podcast, okay, other than donations. This is just so that the podcast can grow. Even if you just put, I enjoy this podcast or something in our star rating, that does help the podcast to reach more fans, more Dark Shadows fans. If you listen on Spotify or Amazon Prime, you can rate there too. You can't write reviews, but you can rate. If you watch the podcast on YouTube, if you would, please just subscribe. That's important. Subscribe to the podcast. Please like the podcast as well. And if you want to ring the bell to be notified, that's good too, because you can be notified of new episodes. But main thing, subscribe and like the videos. Again, that does help the podcast to grow and reach more fans of Dark Shadows who may be interested in this. And most important of all, share the podcast. If you have friends who like Dark Shadows, who like classic horror, who are into this kind of stuff, share it with them. If you think they'd enjoy this, please let them know about the podcast. Tell them about it. There is a Buy Me a Coffee page for the podcast. I mentioned donations. You can donate to Terror at Collinwood at Buy Me a Coffee. I will put a link in the show notes to that. Any donation is appreciated. It does go toward the cost of making the podcast, you know, for the cost of Squarespace. I just got charged the annual fee for Squarespace, the Adobe editing suite, which I use for the podcast. There are a variety of costs associated with doing this, which I pay for out of pocket. So any donation is appreciated. If you enjoy the podcast, please consider donating. And I do want to thank everyone who has donated up until this point. I've received several kind donations from you. So thank you. And thank you to those who have been sharing the podcast and commenting. I see people posting it on social media, which is really appreciated. I'm not in all of the groups. I appreciate all the groups that do let me share the podcast there, but some of them don't, and some groups I'm not in. So if you share the podcast to like Facebook groups or TikTok, I'm not on TikTok. I don't do Reddit, and I do see people posting on those platforms, at least on Reddit I have seen. So thank you to those who are doing those kinds of things. It does help out a lot. I have some really fun stuff coming up in terms of the podcast, some really cool things I'm going to be covering. We're going to be doing the Ross novels. We're going to be doing the Gold Key comics. We're going to be doing the 91 revival series, Dynamite comics, the newspaper strip, you name it. Year four of the podcast, we're going to be branching out into some of the other territories of terror here. So I'm really excited about that. So there's a lot of cool stuff coming up. Great guests also lined up. Hopefully some more cast members too and crew members from Dark Shadows. Lots of fun things coming up. So I do appreciate everybody. I know I've seen a lot of people sharing the show, and I got some new stickers made up. If you come up to me and Burbank on Saturday, I'll have them Saturday, and I'm happy to give you one if you would like. A podcast sticker had the unholy trinity of Barnabas, Quentin, and Angelique logo turned into a sticker. So now it's more than just the Barnabas sticker. Now we got Angelique and Quentin on there too. And so if you come up to me on Saturday, say hello, I'll give you a sticker. Okay, let's end things here, and thank you so much for listening.
And for as long as they lived, the Dark Shadows never truly vanished, for there will always be Terror at Collinwood. Terror at Collinwood is a Penny Dreadful production.